The full moon shone like a polished silver medal when Doyle brought Bridget from the lean-to, half dragging, half carrying her across the camp. She closed her mind to her nudity. Most of the Swampies were as naked as she, and she paid no attention to their jeers and catcalls. Dolefully, Doyle pointed Bridget's attention to the heap of decapitated heads.
They're happy tonight. They killed 6 members of the Mudong cult today, not to mention capturing you and your friend.
As they circled the bonfire, Bridget saw DeFore was as bound and as naked as she was. Like Bridget, she had a few cuts, bruises, and scratches, but nothing worse. The intricate braids she affected had come loose, and her hair hung in wispy strands over her upper shoulders. The face she turned toward Bridget was expressionless, her eyes dull. She looked more than fatigued. She looked exhausted from enduring too many hours of terror. DeFore's escort, though taller and sturdier of build, bore a resemblance to Doyle in that he also appeared out of place. And like Doyle, the ugly cuts inscribed around his eyes were fresh and unhealed. They faced the man Doyle had called Okajnik. He sat on a rattan stool, flanked by a pair of Swampies. On his lap rested DeFore's open medical kit. He poked at its contents, and when Doyle pulled Bridget to a stop in front of him, his eyes flicked up and down her form, and he smiled. His smile was pleasant, as if he were being introduced to her at a social function.
Reba here tells me your name is Bridget.
For a second, Bridget was confused and embarrassed by her confusion. She wasn't sure who Reba was supposed to be, then realized DeFore must have told him her first name, a revelation that had never been shared with Bridget.
It's been a very long time since I've met such charming and refined women. I doubt you believe me if I told you exactly how long it's been.
The pitch, timbre, and vibrations of his voice gently caressed her inner fear like a soothing touch. She felt her fear begin to ebb, but at the same time her skin crawled beneath his intense yellow-green stare. Okajnik removed a small glass ampoule filled with a clear fluid. He studied it, revolving it between thumb and forefinger. Bridget noticed his fingernails were at least 2.5 inches long, tapered to sharp points, and were exceptionally clean.
She further informs me that these liquids could cure the Black Death.
Bridget did not respond until Okajnik angled a questioning eyebrow toward her. She ducked her head.
Yes.
I'm always impressed by the advances in science made by man during my sleeps. Every time I awaken, there seems to be a new one. But how little man changes.
He turned to the Swampy standing on his left.
Legrand, please relate your tale.
Legrand closed his eyes and his swart face took on a studious air.
They come for him. They come from the sky. They come from within, without, without shape, without form. Across the sky and back again. Across the world, over and over. A patchwork, a joining of lands. Tread to a needle, the pathway is hidden. They travel by lightning, by thunder, to the magic of the storm. Harnessed in the caves, the energy electric, the energy forbidden.
Both Bridget and DeFore were able to read between the lines of the man's recitation. What he described sounded suspiciously like a Mattrans jump.
There are 2 brothers. Brothers in all but blood. Brothers in arms and in souls. They will seek 2 women who possess healing knowledge. They will come from the pathways hidden and arrive at the forbidden place of dead science.
Bridget felt a chill go up her back and across the nape of her neck as Legrand stopped speaking and cast expectant eyes toward Okajnik. The man on the stool glanced from Bridget to DeFore.
You have to admit, that certainly describes you 2 ladies.
Perhaps. There is a lot of room for interpretation.
Judging by this little bag of tricks I have here, I'd say the prediction was correct.
He returned the ampoule to the case, closed and latched the lid, and handed it to Legrand.
Take this and dispose of it.
The Swampy bowed and scurried away into the shadows. Okajnik stared directly at Bridget. She tried to avert her gaze, but found herself compelled to meet his eyes. Impressions filled her, not images, but whispering touches of emotion, of abandoned passions, of wantonness, of unbridled and utter release from rules, morals, and inhibitions. She felt her respiration increase, her heartbeat speed up, and with a great conscious effort, Bridget tore her gaze away from his beautiful eyes.
What are you?
The man seemed a little startled, not only by the question, but by the fact she had even asked it.
I presume you would have been told by now. My name is Okaznik.
That's not a proper name. It's an old Serbian word that means he who walks in darkness. There are other derivations.
Very good, Bridget. That name was forced upon me many years, many centuries ago, so I simply adopted it. I've had other names in other lands.
Like Orlok, Nagotha, and Rakshasha?
Not to mention Vlad Tepes and Gilles de Rais.
You still haven't answered my question. What are you?
Would it make any difference to you in your present situation?
It would.
Not everything in existence can be slotted into scientific niches. You want to explain me? Is that it? And therefore diminish what I am? Or what you fear me to be?
And what is that?
A Nagotha. A Rakshasha. A vampire. An entity who lives by an entirely different set of laws than any conceived by your kind's scientists.
There's another possibility.
Oh. And what do you think that would be, Reba?
You're a mutie, like these swampies of yours.
A mutie.
Products of genetic engineering. We call this bunch swampies. They're descendants of a genetic manipulation program called the Genesis Project. You probably had something to do with Enterprise Eternity. Perhaps you're the source of the chimeric cells that bred human vampires.
Go on, Reba.
The more I think about it, the more likely that seems. You're probably a natural-born mutant, exceptionally long-lived, and your genes provided the jumping-off point for 20th-century scientists to tinker, splice, and eventually make more muties.
Mutie.
He rolled the word around on his tongue as if testing the taste and texture of it to see if he liked it. Then he moved. He was so fast, to Bridget's eyes, it was as if he simply vanished from the stool. She felt the rush of air past her cheek. She heard the meaty smack of the blow, as sharp as a gunshot, and DeFore fell heavily onto her back.
Reba!
Bridget saw blood springing from the woman's nostrils. Her eyes rolled back in their sockets, showing only the whites.
Beauty? You dare to presume I am some offal spewed from your kind's experiments? Mutie!
The blazing fury he directed at DeFore's presumption hammered at Bridget, and she flinched back. At the periphery of her vision, she saw Doyle swallowing hard, turning away, fixing his eyes on anything other than the raging monster standing over DeFore.
Do you think you can apply your beast's reason to a god?
Kneeling, Okaznik flipped DeFore roughly onto her face and ripped away the bonds at her wrists with savage economy and blinding speed. Under his hands, she seemed to weigh no more than a child, and the thongs around her wrists parted as if they were rotten string. He rose to his full height, dragging DeFore with him. Her head lolled back on her neck, her arms dangled limply behind her. With one hand supporting the small of her back, Okaznik squeezed the hinges of her jaws, forcing her mouth open.
Now thou shalt learn the wisdom of the Old Ones.
Okaznik put his lips close to DeFore's face, and his black tongue slithered from his mouth, coiling and questing.
Ah!
Bridget made a move as if to lunge toward him, but Doyle restrained her. Turning his head toward her, Okaznik grinned.
Make no move or I'll cry, else I shall rip thy beast's heart from thy chest and force it down this one's throat.
Doyle covered Bridget's mouth with a hand and pressed his lips to her ear.
Do as he says. It's so very important you do as he says.
Bridget swallowed hard, almost overwhelmed by the realization she had never felt so terrified or helpless in her entire life. She could only watch, engulfed by soul-searing horror, as the tip of Okaznik's tongue dabbed delicately at the blood streaming over DeFore's lips. Though the wavering firelight provided uncertain illumination, Bridget was sure she saw a tiny barb right at the end of Okaznik's inhumanly long tongue.
Kiss me and live forever.
And his tongue disappeared between DeFore's parted lips. Her body convulsed, her arms shook in spasms. She came to semi-consciousness, struggling, trying to push Okaznik away, but he only tightened his grip around her waist, pressing her closer. Her frantic struggles weakened, then ceased altogether. After a moment, her ample hips began to undulate. In an instant, Okaznik released her, his tongue withdrawing with a snap, a tiny thread of crimson trailing from its tip. DeFore collapsed bonelessly, shuddering to the ground. Her limbs shook violently as if she were suffering a seizure. She rolled onto her side and retched, vomiting out a jet of blood. She lay in a fetal position, eyes squeezed shut. Okajnik knelt beside her and gently stroked her hair.
A healer thou claim to be. A scientist who travels the pathways invisible, but still only a beast. This is not a penalty for insulting thy master, but rather a gift. There are no universal laws of what is considered to be right and to be wrong. Just definitions that are truly subjective. Man has always acted like a savage. It is twined in thy very nature, and to attempt its removal would leave thee mewling in the dust. Therefore, I am permitting thee to unleash the savage within thee. I will allow thee to be thy true self. What other god would do that?
As he spoke, his hand moved down and lovingly caressed her thighs. As Brigid listened to the sounds rising from her throat, she slowly understood the vocalizations were not of pain, but of arousal. Okajnik continued to touch her, to stroke her carefully, and DeFore jerked, finally rising to all fours, head bowed, abasing herself before the beautiful man with the beautiful eyes and the maddeningly exquisite touch. Firelight glinted on DeFore's face, and Brigid realized the woman was weeping.
Oh, please, please, don't
there,
do it.
Now, free the animal from within the constraints put upon it by thy false civilization.
Okajnik softly touched her again, and her body rocked back and forth. With a flourish, Okajnik swept the flat of his hand over her body.
The leash is loosening. Canst thou not feel it? Free the beast!
Nausea roiled in the pit of Brigid's stomach, and she feared she would throw up while Doyle had his hand clamped over her mouth. She fought down the sickness and watched and listened.
This is me!
Brigid trembled from witnessing the depths of horror and perversion. As the moon reached its zenith, the camp of the Swampies became a crazed, shambling, open-air madhouse. Brigid stood with her eyes dilated, her entire body frozen. Okajnik left DeFore writhing on the ground. The Swampies swarmed around him, and one brought forth a rolled tarpaulin. He spread it out on the ground, and four scar-faced muties positioned themselves at each corner, holding them clear of the ground. Okajnik mingled among the Swampies, the beasts, petting one here, kissing another one there. They danced and capered around him in mindless adoration, trying to catch his notice. At length, Doyle removed his hand from Brigid's mouth.
You must watch this. If you resist, if you try to escape, you will become the object of the game. It will be a far worse fate than your friends.
Looking at DeFore stirring fitfully on the muddy earth, Brigid found that hard to conceive.
Game? What game?
Something the master created to entertain his beasts.
Since Okajnik showed no more interest in DeFore, the Swampies acted as if she weren't there either. They stepped on her, stumbled over her, trampled on her. Hot tears stung Brigid's eyes, and she stepped toward the woman, but Doyle pulled her back.
She's a beast now. Let her lie.
DeFore finally raised her mud and blood-spattered face, looking around unfocusedly. Her lips moved as if she were talking to herself. A Swampy woman nearly tripped over her, looked down, and spit on her bare back.
Is this the defilement you were talking about?
It hasn't even begun.
After a couple of false starts, DeFore managed to totter to her feet, raking her disordered hair out of her eyes. Brigid watched her, nerves wire-taut and trembling, as the woman stumbled blearily, first a few paces backward, then lurching forward. DeFore had been more than humiliated and debased. Her dignity had not only been taken from her, but she had been crumpled and contemptuously tossed away like a soiled tissue. Her identity, her crisp, efficient manner, had been tossed away as well.
DeFore!
The woman acted as if she hadn't heard, or if she had, she didn't recognize the name.
DeFore! DeFore! Reba!
DeFore's head jerked around, brown eyes covered with a wet, glazed sheen.
Over here, Reba!
Like an automaton, DeFore walked toward her. Her lips still moved, and finally Brigid realized what the woman was chanting over and over.
This isn't me, this isn't me, this isn't me.
Brigid couldn't make eye contact, and so she fixed her gaze on Okajnik. She had known anger before, even a wild fury, But never had she felt drowned in hatred. So intense, it seemed to flow almost tangibly along the line of her vision.
I will see you die. If it is possible for you to die, I will be there to watch it happen.
Two Swampies surged from the shadows, carrying between them a squirming, naked girl. She was dusky of complexion, with long, straight black hair. By the contorted expression on her face, she was nearly insane with fear. They hurled her unceremoniously onto the center of the tarp. The Swampies at the corners lifted the big square of canvas, bagging the girl at the bottom. In unison, the four of them began jerking the tarpaulin up and down until the girl flew straight up, arms and legs flailing, hair all a tangle. The Swampies set a steady rhythm. Okajnik stood beside the makeshift trampoline, following the girl's up and down trajectory with a studied, smiling interest. Then his right hand shot out, fingers slashing, and slit a neat gash across her throat. Blood fountained from severed arteries and veins, driven by her wildly pumping heart. Brigid felt warm liquid drops splatter across her face like a brief rain shower. The blood misted across the upturned face of the Swampies as the dying, hemorrhaging girl continued to bounce up and down. Okajnik's tongue darted out to catch a few flying droplets. He raised a hand, and the Swampies stopped propelling her upward, allowing her body to huddle at the bottom of the canvas. They kept the edges upturned, so the blood formed a pool. Okajnik knelt down and plunged first his tongue, then his face into the rising puddle of crimson and began to feed. After only a few seconds, Okajnik raised his head and grinned directly at Brigid. He had changed. Despite the scarlet glistening on his face, Brigid saw the parchment yellow skin, the ropey veins pulsing at the sides of the hairless head, just above the malformed bat-like ears. Sharp, twisted teeth showed in his mouth. But the eyes still glowed yellow-green, the color of the walls of hell. They were not even remotely human. Brigid's overwrought nerves gave. Her reason tottered, staggered, and fell over the edge. Then, for the first time in her life, Brigid Baptiste fainted. The ambush was well planned, an explosion of organized chaos that would have closed like the jaws of a steel trap if one of the Swampies hadn't tripped over a root and fired his crossbow prematurely. The bolt flew short and buried itself in the earth between Grant's feet. His reaction was immediate. The Sin Eater flashed into his hand, and his index finger depressed the trigger stud. Jamming the copperhead against his hip, Kane pressed down the trigger, firing in the opposite direction. Swampies launched themselves out of the bush, defying certain death. Blood spurted and chunks of flesh gouted into the air, intermixed with splinters of bone. They retreated, melting back into the swamp. Kane and Grant relaxed the pressure of their respective trigger fingers before they emptied both their blasters. For a long moment, they heard nothing but bullet-shredded twigs and leaves showering down in a rustling rain.
Has it occurred to you that these bastards expected us?
That occurred to me at least half an hour ago.
How could they know we'd show up?
Then Swampies rushed them like shadows, pressing in from all sides. Kane and Grant fired their Sin Eaters. Flame wreathed the muzzles, casting an unearthly strobing effect on the scarred faces snarling before them. Bodies slammed into Kane, nearly bowling him off his feet, fetching him up hard against a tree trunk. He directed a final tri-burst from his Sin Eater and saw a mutie stagger backward, most of his face vanishing in a bubbling fountain of blood. He used the copperhead as a bludgeon, clubbing away, hands clawing for his face. Other than their crossbows, the Swampies were armed with crude knives and machetes. They hacked and slashed and thrust at the two men. Kane felt the chopping impacts against the tree trunk at his back. In close combat, there was always the temptation to hose bullets around indiscriminately, but both Grant and Kane knew that wasn't the best option. Not only would each be in danger from the other man's barrage, but blasters were useless when it came to hand fighting. Letting the copperhead dangle by its lanyard, Kane swung out with his combat knife, his arm curving up, then down and across a Swampy's throat. Blood sprayed out and over Kane's arm. The mutie stumbled backward, careening off one of his fellows. He was clutching his throat. Crimson seeped out from his fingers as he finally fell on his side, his legs spasming. Using the tree at his back as a brace, he swung the knife in a fast, glittering arc, wheeling on the balls of his feet. The blade slashed through throats, plunged into bellies, withdrew to chop at arms and hands. The Swampies crowded Grant fiercely, one of them slashing at him with a machete. As short as he was, he tried to cut Grant's legs out from under him, but the big man had expected it, weaving away, pivoting to his right, and stabbing at the mutie's neck. The mutie was quick, hunching his head between his shoulders so that he took only a shallow flesh wound on his scalp. Still, blood rivered into his eyes, blinding him momentarily. The Swampy lifted his hands to staunch the flow and clear his vision. Grant drove the knife halfway to the hilt into the side of his throat. A Swampy chopped at Grant with a machete, its thin blade chiming on the honed steel of the big combat knife, deeply notching the metal. The mutie swung the machete again, slashing sideways this time in an effort to shear his adversary's head from his shoulders. Grant ducked under the effort and kicked at the Swampy's knee from a crouching position. The Swampy didn't fall, swinging the machete again as Grant came back up to a standing position. He parried the blow and slashed out with his knife in a lightning countermove. The knife ripped open the man's belly, but still he didn't fall, even after half of his intestines fell in blue-sheened loops nearly to his knees. Holding in his guts with one hand, the Swampy raised the machete over his head. Stomach boiling with nausea, Grant swung his knife from the shoulder. The mutie's body reeled to the left, while his head tumbled to the right. A snarling Swampy lunged forward, grabbing at the front of Grant's suit. Unbelievably powerful fingers found a grip on the fabric and gave a terrific yank down. Grant bent at the waist, and his chin hit the mutie's upthrust kneecap. The top layer of the garment tore in the Swampy's fingers, and Grant pushed himself erect and moved toward the mutie with a single whip-fast movement. The Swampy bounded forward headfirst to meet him, driving the top of his skull into Grant's gut. He staggered back on his boot heels. Only a tree trunk kept him from falling. The mutie took a faltering step back. Then his lips opened and a stream of vermilion spilled out. Grant glimpsed a tendril of smoke curling from the boar of the Sin Eater in Kane's hand.
Last round till I reload.
Right!
Grant gripped his knife tighter and closed in on another Swampy. Back and forth the battle rolled, blades slashing and chopping, scarlet streams spurting, feet stamping the fallen underfoot. The attack ended with the same abruptness with which it had begun. The Swampies did not so much engage in a retreat as melt back into the shadow-splotched foliage. Kane and Grant leaned against trees, trembling with sick weariness, knives dangling from their hands.
You hurt?
Kane shook his head, and the swamp spun around him. He winced at the stabbing pain of the arrow strike, an injury he'd forgotten during the adrenaline rush of the battle.
Don't think so. You?
Don't think so. We were damn lucky, this time.
Grant examined the rips in his environmental suit with disbelieving eyes.
How can those little sons of bitches be so strong?
Did you catch that word that some of them were screaming, Okajnik? What does that mean?
How do I know? I don't speak Swampy.
Swampies speak Creole, a sort of French dialect. That word didn't sound like French to me.
I don't give a shit whether they speak French or Russian. Which way did they go?
Doesn't matter.
Both men quickly reloaded their blasters. Kane pushed himself away from the tree as Grant took in a lungful of the humid, fetid air.
Whichever direction we're going in, let's get moving.
They heard a prolonged rustle from the underbrush, as if a wind shook the leaves, but they felt not so much as a hint of a breeze. The sound made the flesh creep along the spines of both men. They shone their microlights toward the foliage, and the beam reflected off a constellation of tiny sparks at ground level.
What the fuck?
Then a rat launched itself from the ground at his face, and his Sin-Eater blasted deafeningly. The rodent was hurled upward by the impact of lead and thudded to the ground. Suddenly, a black mass swept toward them like a thundercloud scudding only inches above the ground, blotting out leaves, twigs, and creepers. A shudder shook Kane violently. The sight of those 100 deadly little beasts with teeth whose bite meant death turned his stomach as no mutie ever had.
Which way?
That doesn't matter.
They began a shambling run through the morass, ducking and dodging along paths that zigged and zagged like the trail left by a broken-backed snake. The ground became marshier, until at every step their boots sank ankle-deep into the muck. The farther they ran, the more the bayou closed in. The two men waded through many shallow pools and avoided equally many deep ones. It was necessary to swim on two occasions, because channels that cut across their path couldn't be circled. In the first one, nothing occurred except Kane's briefly choking on a mouthful of rancid water. As they left the second, and the dripping Grant hauled himself out onto the bank, Kane saw the black water roil and bubble ominously, as if something large moved off the bottom toward the surface. They moved on, stopping periodically to rest and pick off huge brown leeches, nasty things 6 inches long that clung to their one-piece garments.
hospitable place, Louisiana.
Grant gingerly inserted the point of his knife between a sluggishly squirming leech and the crotch of his environmental suit. The Swampies were still tracking them. The two men started moving again, away from the calls.
How many of these slaggers are we gonna have to chill before they give up?
As long as one of them can walk, they won't give up.
Sure wish we could find another one of those giant swampy gobbling plants you found last time you tangled with these bastards. The hell was that?
It could be anything in this place.
They had no choice but to keep moving forward, but they'd gone less than 100 yards before they were forced to stop at the edge of a big patch of open marshland. The area was well lit by the bright stars and full moon. The mud shone silver in places. Humping out of the middle of it, they saw a small island made of partly dead, partly growing plant matter. Grant pointed to it.
That might make a good place to hide out until morning. We'd be able to see and hear the Swampies before they could get to us.
Kane eyed the stretch of muddy marsh to the island and shook his head.
We'd leave a trail.
Grant nodded in agreement and turned away. The reeds on the far side of the marsh suddenly parted, and 4 Swampies materialized from the shadows.
Fuck!
The 4 Swampies were more than the walking wounded. They looked like walking autopsies. One had half of his hip and thigh shot away, exposed bone and muscle glinting wetly. The right arm of another man dangled by strings of gristle and muscle tissue. The 3rd Swampy bled from several bullet holes in his chest. Only the 4th mutie displayed no apparent injury. He extended his loaded crossbow.
Good sport, Villman. You're tough. But the game is over now.
Grant shouldered his subgun. Kane raised his copperhead, setting the butt against his shoulder. He gauged the range at around 80 feet, and he switched the selector switch to single shot.
I'm down to my last full magazine for the copperhead. How about you?
I've got less than half a full load. We can't afford to miss with these headshots.
There's probably more behind them, you know.
I have that very same impression. I'll take the 2 on the right. You take...
The island of vegetable matter rose, heaving itself out of the mud. Filthy water streamed and splattered down. The creature dimly resembled a turtle, but the great opalescent eyes were set 3 feet apart on the blunt-beaked head. Its monstrous, scaled, bowed legs were like tree trunks, supporting a huge, horny shell the size of a Land Rover. Foot-long, scimitar-curved claws tipped the webbed toes. Grant and Kane froze, and the Swampies came to a shambling halt. The two men didn't bother to aim their weapons at the vast, wet bulk rising from the mud. The blasters in their hands felt like toys. They simply weren't designed to deal with a threat on the scale of the creature. The creature extended its massive head from beneath the overhang of its shell, its plate-sized nostrils quivering. Cold eyes fixed on the Swampies standing at the edge of the marsh.
It smells their blood. They're bleeding into the mud, and that's what's roused it.
Propelled by its gargantuan legs and flat feet, the creature lunged out of the marsh like a coiled spring. Before Grant and Kane could even blink, the weight of what must have been tons hit the mucky ground of the bank. The impact sent mud cresting in a wave, drenching the two men with filthy water and bits of plants. The creature's great limbs kicked and flailed, and its beaked snout opened, then closed with a snap. A Swampy writhed between the huge jaws. Bones crunched, and the lower half of the man fell to the ground, while his torso slid down the monster's gullet, swallowed in a single gulp. Kane and Grant turned and ran in the opposite direction.
He's just not gonna regenerate from that.
No shit.
As they struggled through a copse of ferns, Kane shook his head.
I thought the giant variety of mutie animals were extinct.
So?
So, over the last couple of months, we've run into a sandworm, a giant snake, and now that thing.
Under the circumstances, you should be more concerned about us becoming extinct.
Kane and Grant continued on, not stopping until they were more or less certain they had evaded what was left of their pursuers. After wading hip-deep across a scum-filled stream, they reached high ground and paused to catch their breath near a high-rooted mangrove. Listening, Kane raised a brow at Grant, who shrugged. When they moved on, they did so at a cautious walk. They hadn't advanced more than a few yards when they saw the man's arm. Dusky of complexion, it was wrapped in the bloody tatters of a shirt sleeve. At one end, a hand contracted around the wooden handle of a machete. At the other end was a mess of splintered bone and hacked flesh. Kane stooped over it, poking at the hand with the tip of his combat knife.
Whoever it belonged to wasn't a Swampy. He's got fingernails. It's not more than a few hours old.
Grant played his microlight along the muddy trail.
There's the rest of him.
They went to the corpse and realized quickly that Grant's assessment had been wrong. The man's body had two arms, but he was missing his head. A few yards away, they found the man who'd had his arm lopped off. Lying beside him was another decapitated corpse, and next to him was a dead Swampy with a hole in his forehead. A bullet had struck the mutie just above the left eye, leaving a neat dark hole from which blood still seeped. The exit wound was huge. A portion of skull the size of Grant's fist had been blown out, bone, blood, and brain matter mixing with the ooze of the ground.
Somebody's got blasters around here. Looks like a 30-30 might have done that.
Yeah, that somebody doesn't seem to like Swampies any more than we do.
Straightening up, Kane splashed his light around and saw more corpses, at least six of them, minus their heads. And unlike the severed arm, the heads were nowhere in sight. His point man's sense rang a faint alarm, but he wasn't sure of the trigger.
Hell of a fight here. Looks like the Swampies were collecting heads.
Whose heads?
Ours, mes amis. Hold it there. Drop the blasters. Keep your hands in the air now and turn around slow.
Kane's keen ears had heard not a single sound until the commands had been given. However, even if the words were hard to understand, the intent and delivery were unmistakable. Grant and Kane did as they were told, letting the copperheads fall from their fingers into the dirt. Weary and winded, they needed time to size up the situation, and they couldn't think of any better way to do so than turning around. Surrounding them in a semicircle was a group of half a dozen men. A seventh person was mounted on horseback. Kane saw it was a woman, a girl, really. Her skin was a warm chocolate in color, and her dark eyes were only a shade lighter. Her nose was very straight, her nostrils flaring widely out, and her lips were full and pouting. Her great mass of dreadlocked hair tumbled in thick braids to her waist. She wore jeans, sandals, and a man's ragged, buttonless flannel shirt. The tails were knotted at her midriff and barely covered her breasts. Silver glinted at her bosom, bright against the darkness of her skin. Her eyes were cold and strange, yet gleaming with intelligence and resolve. She wasn't beautiful in the conventional sense, but there was a wild loveliness about her that held the eyes of both Kane and Grant. Beside her horse crouched a four-legged, black-and-tan shape. It was the biggest dog either man had ever seen, with a huge head and a shovel-shaped underslung jaw from which dark ivory fangs protruded. The woman's male companions had also been on horseback, three per side. Some of them were Caucasian, while others looked as if they were a mixture of Indian and black. The woman stayed in the saddle of the dun mare, perched in the stirrups, peering down at them in the moonlight. Every man there had a gun trained on Grant and Kane, a lethal mix of rifles and pistols. One man aimed a lever-action Winchester at Grant's chest.
Like I said, a 30-30.
Kane didn't respond. Regardless of their weaponry, there were too many to outshoot, and nowhere to run except into the arms of Swampies or the teeth of rats.
Those big-ass blades, mes amis. We'll take them off your hands as well.
One of the men claimed Kane's combat knife, sliding it into a sash. He gave Kane a quick pat-down to check for other weapons. He moved on to Grant.
What evil path brings you into this land?
We seek missing friends.
You are in trouble. There are powerful enough problems here yet to come without outlanders like you showing up to muddy the waters.
Like what? The plague?
Or the shitload of swamp muties creeping around here collecting heads?
The woman and several of the men looked at each other with uneasy surprise. The woman gave them an annoyed look.
What are your names?
Kane.
Grant.
Who are the friends you seek? Two women.
Now it was their turn to stare with uneasy surprise.
Yes. Have you seen them?
Does one of them practice the healing arts?
You might say that.
Do you travel by the pathways invisible?
Kane and Grant hesitated before replying, exchanging a brief glance. Knowledge of the Matran's gateways was one of the most ruthlessly guarded secrets in post-nuke America. However, it was obvious the people who lived in the region had been inside the redoubt many times.
You might say that. Would you mind telling us who you are?
The young woman sat up straighter in the saddle.
I am called Mama Esther.
You don't look old enough to be anybody's mama.
No, Monsieur Grant. It is a title bestowed upon me by the people of Mudong. I am the High Priestess of Vodou, although I don't expect you to understand what that means.
Voodoo?
I am impressed. Now both of you will come with us.
Kane and Grant didn't move, and gun barrels snapped up. Caught in a bad situation that looked to be deteriorating, Kane cursed himself for a number of reasons. First and foremost, for getting caught flat-footed by a bunch of mush-mouthed Cajuns. He was so exhausted and wrung out, he hadn't responded to the alarm triggered by his point man's sixth sense. Grant made a dismissive gesture with his upraised left hand.
As much as we appreciate the invitation, we should find our way back to those pathways invisible.
I don't think you understand. Your arrival was foretold.
Foretold by who?
By me, in a vision. Therefore, you are coming with us.
That's what you think.
The strangely silent Cajuns moved in to flank them, the closest ones holstering their guns so their hands would be free. The two largest men took the lead positions, both wider and taller than Kane, but there was nothing about them that could be considered flabby or fat. They were lean, hard men, much like Grant and Kane themselves, all muscle. Both had dark, bony faces and flashing dark eyes. There was no malice in their faces, only calm resolve. Two more men bracketed Grant. Each of them took an arm and a wrist, clamping down firmly with their strong fingers and hands. The result had Grant and Kane feeling that they were in the grip of mighty steel talons. They didn't bother to struggle or prevent the Cajuns from stripping their sin-eaters from their forearms. They conserved their flagging energy and their fading strength. Esther still had talking to do. That much the two men could discern from the woman's placid demeanor.
If you take us by force, other people will come after us. By those pathways invisible, and they won't be as friendly as we are. That's not a threat, but a cold, hard fact.
I don't believe you, Monsieur Kane. I did not see any others arriving by the path but you and two women. They are with the Old One, and you will be with us. A balance of assets.
What if we say no?
Oh, you may say no all you wish. It might amuse the Loa. Regardless of how many times you say it, you will still be coming with us. If you choose to do so unwillingly, then you must pay the price.
Kane lost what was left of his frayed temper. The two Cajuns began dragging Kane forward, and he practiced a simple and time-honored move. He lifted his leg and stomped down as hard as he could with his boot heel, mashing it into the instep of one man's foot. Since the Cajun wore only sandals, Kane felt the delicate metacarpal bones break beneath his heel. The sudden overwhelming pain caused the man to involuntarily release his upper arm, freeing Kane to deal with the second captor. Kane fell back, snaking his upper body to the left and swinging out with his right fist. Kane stayed balanced on the balls of his feet, raising his hands for protection and keeping Grant to his back. The man he had stomped lurched forward and brought up his knee, smashing it into Kane's crotch. The environmental suit had cushioned the impact, but still he staggered and deliberately dropped to his right knee. The man, favoring his injured foot, tried driving his knee into his face. With his left arm, Kane deflected the knee and reached out, palm up, and clutched the man's testicles, which he squeezed as hard as he could. The Cajun flailed, but Kane maintained the hold as a form of payback. His MAG martial arts instructor called it Monkey Steals the Peach. The men flanking Grant, startled by the sound of the shrill screams ripping out of the throat of their companion, were almost motionless. Grant decided to move, yanking free of the Cajun on his right and shooting his left elbow back into his throat. The man staggered backward, holding his throat with both hands, his tongue protruding from his mouth.
Stop this at once!
The Cajuns converged on Kane and Grant with fists, feet, and gun butts. To both Kane and Grant, it was as if they were reliving the day of their final examinations when they were 16, their last day as recruits, and their first as badge-carrying Koboldville magistrates. The test had no true name, but everyone called it Blood Stomper. There was no such thing as failure in the examination. Those who survived it were the ones who didn't fail. The sledgehammers of Kane's youth were back in full force, each of them thudding down against his skin, hitting bone and muscle. What the Cajuns did to him on the bayou brought all those memories back in a rush. His vision blurred, and he felt vomit rise into the back of his throat. His mouth was hit by a fist, and his teeth cut his lower lip, bringing salt and blood. His own sweat blinded his vision, but he caught a blurry impression of Grant going down under two rifle butts. There was no way to prepare for the pummeling he received. Open and closed hands smashed into his face while feet drove into his belly. He managed to get off a vicious kick of his own, very well placed, and had the satisfaction of seeing a man rolling in agony on the ground, clutching his groin. For his effort, the kick was returned twofold. Kane's head fell forward, face down. A heavy foot landed on the back of his neck, mashing his face into the moist earth. He struggled and managed to turn his head to one side to keep his nostrils and mouth clear. He screwed his eyes shut and then blinked them open, trying to stay conscious. He failed. Waves of pain pushed Kane's consciousness out of the inky depths. Each throb was expanded by the jostling of the trotting horse he was tied to. At least the pain meant he was still alive, and he could use it to keep his mind centered. The sledges were still hammering along, hitting him in time with the sound of the horse's hoofbeats as it broke into a gallop on the old scrub path. The world around him was gray in the night. He wanted to curse, but lacked the necessary strength to open his mouth and form the words. All he could do was breathe, and even that was labored and painful through an aching ribcage. From the jostling and the confusing mess of dimly moonlit ground and sky, Kane realized he was tied over the saddle of the horse, belly down, legs on one side and arms on the other. Draped over the saddle leather like a sack of potatoes and feeling about as lively, he was seeing the world upside down. His ankles and wrists were bound to the stirrups, and he wondered if Grant was enjoying the same travel accommodations. Kane tried to move, wiggling his lower body where it rested across the horse's back. The end effect was to make his guts feel as if they were going to fall out of his mouth, and the horse still kept running. He was grateful he hadn't eaten anything solid in more than a day. The horse's gait faltered, and its pace slowed to a merciful walk. He heard it blowing noisily, snorting as if irritated. He tried to lift his head, but he felt the pressure of a hand on the back of his neck holding him down.
We're almost home, Monsieur Kane. I regret bringing you in such a fashion, but it was your choice. Every choice has a price.
The cobwebs stretched over Bridget's eyes were too thick to see through at first. She could see only patterns of light, some dark, some bright, moving around slowly. Then she felt someone systematically slapping her face. The cobwebs parted, and she saw Doyle looking down at her. She lay in his lap, his head and shoulders silhouetted by the bonfire flaring madly behind him.
You've got to wake up! I can't protect you if you don't wake up!
Bridget blinked, craned her neck, and saw a Swampy grinning lasciviously down at her, the one Okajnik had addressed as Le Grand. His lips glistened with blood, his teeth red-filmed. He had pushed his loincloth to one side and rubbed his half-erect and uncircumcised penis vigorously. She tried to rise, hampered by her bound hands. Her surroundings slowly came back into focus. Swampies clustered around the tarp on their hands and knees, drinking the blood, gorging themselves on it. She was irresistibly reminded of a clump of ticks sucking on blood until they were bloated. Okajnik stood and watched, eyes dreamy, the handsome host again, except for the wet scarlet coating his face and staining his clothes and hands. The sexual tension was rich and thick as the coppery tang of fresh blood. Doyle helped Bridget to her feet, and as she swayed unsteadily, temples throbbing, she saw DeFore standing close by, head bowed, eyes open but not seeing. Okajnik beamed at Bridget.
Have you realized the arrogance of human reason now? What does humanity know of the mysteries of this earth? It is a terrible shock to come to the understanding that common laws have no validity or true significance. You need time to rest, to come to terms with what you have learned. Later, you will learn more. You may contemplate all this in the pit. Doyle, take them.
With hands on both women's shoulders, Doyle guided DeFore and Bridget through the camp. DeFore shuffled along sluggishly, barely lifting her feet more than an eighth of an inch above the ground. She moved like a somnambulist. Most of the swampy men and women had consumed large quantities of home brew and were stumble-footed drunk. They passed several who had been violently ill and were lying in pools of their own vomit. Others lay completely passed out. Children wandered around, helping themselves to pots of food.
Did Okajnik kiss all of them?
He didn't have to. They've been waiting for his return for a long time since Skydark. They're a part of him. They always have been.
How can that be? The products of genetic engineering.
Yes.
Doyle pulled the two women to a halt before a pallet of crudely nailed wooden slats. He lifted it away, revealing a cistern-like pit.
You must go down there.
Bridget eyed the edge of the hole and involuntarily drew back.
What's down there?
Nothing. Yet.
Doyle stepped behind her and Bridget felt a pressure between her wrists. Then her hands were free. Doyle surreptitiously pocketed the knife as Bridget raised her hands, looking at the rawhide thongs half buried in the flesh of her wrists. She tried to flex her fingers while hiding the agony of returning circulation from Doyle.
Why must we go down there?
Two men, brothers in all but blood, will come looking for you. If they cannot see you, they cannot find you.
With that, Doyle put a hand on the small of her back and propelled her over the edge of the hole. Bridget did not allow a cry of fright to escape her lips as she plummeted into the pit. The fall was short, less than 10 feet, and cushioned by the thick mud at the bottom. DeFore landed awkwardly, nearly on top of her. Doyle placed the pallet back over the opening. Some pale moonlight spilled down between the slats. She and DeFore crouched in the mud, not speaking or moving. By any sane measurement, Bridget knew she should be terrified and despondent. Okajnik's power over the Swampies seemed absolute, and it required a conscious effort for her to keep from surrendering to utter despair. She glanced over at the mud-smeared DeFore, who sat hugging her knees, her eyes darting wildly like some trapped animal. The woman's external identity had been peeled away. Doctor, scientist, rebel, exposing the naked beast within. Silently, Bridget Baptiste vowed she would not allow that to happen to her. She had been taken prisoner several times in the past, but never had she felt so helpless. She forced her intellect to battle the terror clouding her mind, and she sought to establish a balance between analysis and horror.
DeFore!
The woman twitched as if the sound of her name were like the sting of a whip against her bare flesh.
Reba, Kane and Grant, maybe even Domi will come after us. They may be close. We've got to be ready.
DeFore showed no sign that she understood.
We've got to think our way through this. We've got to come up with something to change the set of variables.
Bridget fell silent, then clumsily moved over to sit beside DeFore. She tried to edge away, but the damp walls of the pit kept her from moving too far. Bridget put an arm around her shoulders. DeFore's muscles were so locked, so rigid, it was like trying to hug a bronze statue. To survive, one needed a clear head. Bridget worked hard to keep hers that way, and now she tried just as hard to clear DeFore's.
I think your hypothesis that Okajnik was the source of the chimeric cells used by Enterprise Eternity, which created the Cornelius family, may be dead on. Of course, that doesn't explain exactly what he is or where he came from, but it gives us a jumping-off point for some halfway educated guesses. I know speculating and theorizing gets on your nerves, but just bear with me. It helps to talk this out.
DeFore half-closed her eyes, face impassive.
Let's proceed from the assumption that all folklore has a basis in fact, distorted and disguised, but that legends are indications of actual occurrences. Over time, the true historical connection is lost or forgotten. Perhaps thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of years ago, a race of entities existed that were feared both as demons and gods. Elemental spirits, maybe. Creatures made primarily of energy. Okajnik may be one of them. His powers are inherent and natural, seeking control by a form of mental and emotional parasitism, as a vampire sucks blood by instinct rather than by any conscious design. Maybe he and others like him became the source of all vampire legends.
The metallic tension in DeFore's body relaxed a bit, just a little, almost imperceptibly, but it was enough to encourage Bridget to go on.
Furthermore, like all parasites, Okajnik must give something back to his host, a beneficial side effect, even if it is superficial and transitory. He can project feelings of pleasure at the same time he's draining his victims of energy, giving a sense that all is good, tricking the host's physical and spiritual senses. There's an actual biological side effect, sexual in nature. Doyle mentioned something about the release of endorphins.
Endogenous morphine controls the body's reaction to pain. It plays a role in pleasurable activities like eating and sex.
Exactly.
Bridget did not allow the relief at DeFore's participation in the discussion, as subdued as it was, to register either in her voice or manner. She acted as if she had expected it all along.
It is possible Okajnik adjusts the release of endorphins in the human body. He does this instinctively. Vampires are popularly believed to be addicted to blood. Maybe it's not just the blood that causes a habitual reliance, but the pleasure-inducing chemicals produced by our own bodies. He can tamper with the systems governing the internal production of endorphins. This works out for him because the critical, reasoning parts of the brain move slowly. Erotic thoughts and a fixation on physical sensation become dominant. It's a form of biochemical mind control. It's significant that both you and Doyle used the same phrase, "it's not me," to describe how you felt. The higher brain functions, though impaired, still operate on a nominal level, so you can at least understand what is happening.
DeFore stirred slightly, her muscles losing a bit more of their rigidity.
Maybe critical enzyme activity is inhibited as well. causing the neurons to fire repeatedly.
Yes, that seems likely.
Then that means that...
As DeFore's words trailed off, she bowed her head and bit her lip. Bridget pulled her closer.
That means what happened to you wasn't your fault.
DeFore lost what little control she had left, then shaking and crying, rocking to and fro. Bridget held her tightly, letting her pump out every drop of shame and humiliation. Tears flowed from her eyes, cutting runnels through the grime caked on her cheeks.
It wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't you.
How can we stop him?
I don't know. But he's flesh and blood, and therefore he can be hurt.
But if he's not human?
In mythic lore, if a demon assumes the attributes of mankind, then its flesh can perish. Even if he is an old one, a vampire, he has the limitations of a human body. He's vulnerable.
But what about the plague? The rats? How does he control that?
I don't know. Traditionally, vampires are able to control the meaner things in nature, the vermin, the scavengers. There could be a form of telepathy at work here, a psychic interdependence.
Or it could be there's no explanation. It could be just what it looks like. Supernatural, demonic. And Okashnik has nothing to do with stimulating endorphins or body chemicals.
I won't accept that. I can't accept that.
Do you really think Grant and Kane will come for us?
That's about the only thing I'm sure about.
With the risks they take, we don't know that they didn't get themselves chilled in South America.
I know they didn't. Just like I know they're somewhere out in the swamp already looking for us.
How do you know that?
I just know.
The head ruled the body. Thinking came before emotions, but Bridget always shied away from trying to explain the bond between herself and Kane. Logically, there was no explanation. They were bound by spiritual chains, linked to each other and the same destiny. She recalled another name she had for him, Anamkara. In the Gaelic tongue, it meant soul friend. Dreams they'd had during a Matrans jump suggested that not only had they lived past lives, but in all those lives, they were continually intertwined with each other in some manner. The idea that she and Kane had existed at other times in other lives had seemed preposterous to her when it had first come up. Maybe it still would have if she hadn't experienced those jump dreams herself. Resolutely, Bridget pushed the conjectures away. What mattered most was survival until Kane and Grant arrived. She knew they would, because believing anything else would have been intolerable. It seemed as if hours passed in the pit. Bridget wondered why sunrise didn't come. At other times, she felt that time was not moving at all, and it had been only minutes since they were placed in the hole. Time became immeasurable. Finally, she dozed off, but she awoke in what felt like seconds. It was still dark, but she heard a scuff and scrape of feet above her. She looked up, but quickly looked away as loose dirt from the edge of the hole sifted down into her face. Someone was lifting away the wooden pallet, and fear and hope warred in her mind. Then a rat landed on her lap. She kicked the little thing hard. DeFore struggled as another rat plunged down from above, then another and another.
Hey, you bitches! We think you need some company down there!
Bridget felt leathery paws touch her bare shoulder, and she tore a rat from her back and smashed it headfirst against the wall of the pit. Her breath came hot and short in her throat.
Kane, where are you?
The Ville, if it could be called that, was set in the center of a bowl-shaped hollow, a natural amphitheater. It wasn't more than a jumble of tar paper shacks and red-roofed huts built around a large concrete structure, probably an old outbuilding from a pre-dark estate. Like everywhere else Kane and Grant had been that night, the main thoroughfare of the Ville was choked with mud. A row of public outhouses lined the bank of a wide stream. Rows of flat-bottomed, sharp-prowed boats were tied to the posts of a splintery wharf stretching out over the stream. The people, for the most part, were swarthy of complexion, although it was hard to ascertain whether their skin tone came naturally or was just residue from living in the swamps. The makeshift settlement was like dozens Grant and Kane had seen over the years in the Outlands. Bills like this, far from the authority of the baronies, were used as refuges by slaggers, men and women who lived outside the law, often with a blood price on their heads. After Kane and Grant were untied from the horses, they entered the concrete block building, wobble-kneed and bleary-eyed, behind Mama Esther. A brass bell and striker hung by the door. She opened it and waved them in. The first thing they noticed was the coolness of the room. The interior was air-conditioned, and the temperature difference was akin to walking face-first into a glacier. The building had electricity, at least in the form of some kind of on-site generator. Luxuries like this were almost unheard of in the Outlands. That meant at least one person in the Ville was competent with writing and machines. Techies were worth their weight in Ville scrip and got the best rates on the open market for their talents. The cool air was such a blessed relief, neither man was inclined to protest the rough treatment or the manner in which they had arrived in the Ville for fear of being booted back out into the humid hell. Also, the two men shouldering Winchesters were strong inducements to keep their tongues curbed. Following the directions of the riflemen, they went into a small bathroom and stripped off their mud and blood-encrusted environmental suits. With water that flowed from the spigot, they did what they could to clean themselves. Both of them moved stiffly because of pain from their beatings. Kane's vision was still slightly blurred. They dressed in ragged shirts and patched jeans provided by one of the men. They kept the boots from the environmental suits. Mama Esther guided them to a wooden table and gestured for them to sit down at the benches.
Now, let me look at you.
To their surprise, she examined them quickly, professionally, and thoroughly. Her long, beringed fingers probed and prodded their bodies expertly.
Well, Kane, you probably have mild concussion. You, Grant? Might be some cracked ribs from all the kicking. I know you are tired and wanting to rest, but that we cannot afford. Not until tonight's business is done. Now, you must eat to regain your strength. I'm sure you are hungry.
From an adjacent doorway, two barefoot girls wearing thin cotton dresses of dirty white brought them dishes made of turned wood with bent and rusty metal knives and forks. The food smelled enticing and sharply reminded Grant and Kane how long it had been since they had last eaten. Still, they exchanged wary glances. Mama Esther caught the brief eye exchange.
Eat now. We talk later.
They ate a hearty meal of cornbread, black-eyed peas, spiced crayfish, and rice, washing it all down with clear, clean, cold water. Mama Esther waited until they were almost finished before starting to talk.
I'm a Vodo priestess, a Ungong, as was every member of my family going back hundreds of years. Do either of you know what the practice of Vodo entails?
You make dolls and push pins into them? Black magic?
I'm surprised you Veal men know even that much, no matter that it's wrong. It is the practice of white and black magic. It originated in the ancient religions of Western Africa, brought here by people sold into slavery. Like all magic, Vodo depends on the cooperation of spirits, demons, and deities. We call these spirits the Loa, and Ungans such as myself are their intermediaries. Ungans have many responsibilities, not just to the Unsi, the congregation, but to the Loa. We undergo a long training, an initiation period, all in absolute secrecy. Mine began when I was but 6. Fully initiated Ungons have what you call magic powers. I can see things that are about to happen. All of us wear symbols of the Loa from whom our powers derive. This is mine.
By thumb and forefinger, Esther lifted a small silver cross that dangled by a thong from her neck. The crucifix was of hammered silver, set with tiny beads. At the ends of the transverse arms, small feathers fluttered.
This is the cross of St. John the Baptist, handed down from the first Ungon of my family, Daddy Lefebvre. St. John joined the ranks of the Loa when he was decapitated 2,000 years ago. There's a huge assemblage of Loas, and they choose certain Ungons to watch and help, like guardian angels. But the goodwill of the Loa is not obtained for nothing. The Ungon upon whom he smiles must not fail to oblige him in his wishes. If we contact our Loa for help and we disregard what they tell us, they take away our powers, maybe our souls. My Loa tell me about you, about the women you seek. So now you understand why I had to bring you here. I had no choice. Not only our lives at stake, but souls.
She looked speculatively from Grant to Kane, waiting for their reaction.
Do you know where the women we seek can be found?
I do indeed. The Swampies have them, and Okajnik has the Swampies.
Back up a little. What do you mean the Loa told you about us?
Your coming was foretold. Neither of you put a lot of stock in prophecy, do you?
It's plain you do.
I use any and all tools at my disposal, Monsieur Grant. Wouldn't you?
So you and your slaggers nearly beat us to death because of a prophecy?
You had the choice of coming of your own free will.
I hate mind readers. Rather have a sticky at my throat. At least with them, you know what you're getting in the way of a mutie.
A mutie? You have gotten me confused with someone else.
What was the prophecy? How can you be so sure it pertains to us?
Esther closed her eyes and leaned back in her chair.
They come for him. They come from within. They come across the sky and back again. Across the world and over. A patchwork. A joining of the lands. Tread to a needle. The pathway is hidden. They travel by lightning, by thunder. Through the magic of the storm. Harnessed in the caves. The energy electric. Worse. The energy forbidden. Explosive. Destructive. Yet still they come. They still come. There are two brothers. Brothers in all but blood. Brothers in arms and souls. They will seek to women who possess healing knowledge. They will come from the pathways hidden and arrive at the forbidden place of dead science.
Kane felt a chill go up his back and across the nape of his neck as Esther stopped speaking. It was obvious the forbidden place of dead science was Redoubt 47.
You have to admit, that certainly describes us.
Maybe.
There is no maybe. Otherwise, I would never have gone out to find you. If the Loa's words were true, and they have never proved wrong before, I knew you were on the way.
So why not wait until we got here?
Because time was running out. What I saw is a danger to both of us. My foes are your own.
What foes? Swampies?
We. Those you call Swampies were created by unnatural means. The forbidden science. They are an affront to God. To the Loa. They were spawned by the residue of the old one, Okajnik.
I don't understand. Swampies are muties.
From what we know of them, they were created by something called the Genesis Project. We're not quite sure why, but since they have double circulatory and cardiovascular systems, it's pretty apparent they were bred for war.
That is the legend among my people, too. Black sorcery mixed with even blacker science. An old one's essence mingled with human blood. We have lived in peace with them for many years, though they are not to be trusted. Long ago, they swore their allegiance to Okajnik. They waited for his return, and now, at last, he has come.
Who's this Okajnik?
He is a what, Monsieur Grant? An old one. One of the last of the Elder Things to stand before the tide of man and reason.
That's not very precise.
How can one be precise about the nature of evil? Pure evil. Not leavened or weakened by any emotion. He is Okajnik. A creature who has never died. He woos all the darkness within the human soul like a lover. He knows the wisdom that has lasted out of the eons in the blackness beneath the earth. He is the king of the shadowy hordes that revel among the tombs of the ancient dead when night veils the swamps and the rats crawl among the offal. Those he kisses live forevermore in the darkness of the spirit. Daddy Lefebvre was the first of my line to contain Okajnik nearly 300 years ago.
So opposing this old one is like, what, a family business?
Over a century later, his work was undone by one of your white coats. The old one was found here in the bayou and revived by scientists who are obsessed with violating the fundamental will of God by finding a means to make man immortal. The old one, ever the deceiver, the trickster, went along with them in their hidden bunker, amused by their clicking computers, their vials of fluids, their hypodermics. They thought he was the answer to their mystery. Ha! Blind fools, rushing to their doom. Okajnik saw the white coats as a means to an end, to create a ready-made slave race.
Grant, the chimeric cells Lakish told us about must have come from Okajnik.
Is that possible?
Why not? And if his cells were spliced to swampy DNA, that might be how he controls them, a genetic link.
Then came the nukes. Whole nations were blotted out. The sky became dark and the world was hurled back into savagery. For a century and a half, Okashnik ruled this land, and those you call swampies, they marked themselves with a brand to show who was their master. And by this mark, they might recognize one another.
With a finger, she traced lines around her eyes.
It looked for a time as if he and his children might prevail and plunge the world back to the primordial horrors of the ancient times. But my great-great-grandmother, Mama Minuit, and her own sea were able to contain Okashnik yet again.
Contain him? What's with all this containing shit? Why didn't she just chill him?
The old ones cannot die, Monsieur Grant. Though when they assume the form of human, they are subject to many of the limitations of humanity. All men know this of the ancient gods, who often appeared in the guise of mortals. In human form, they can only use human faculties. They can be wounded by certain weapons.
Like what?
Silver for one, salt for another.
Silver and salt?
Providing they are both properly blessed and purified, of course.
So now this Okashnik is back?
He is awake and walking the shadows again, oui. He has already gathered his followers. This night, they set upon my people, slaughtering many, taking their heads as trophies. Soon they will come again to murder us all. If we cannot be made Okashnik slaves, then we will die. If we do not stop them, the plague brought forth by Okashnik will spread, killing everyone who lives in this land, maybe the whole world.
That's a pretty tall order.
Okashnik has plenty of time. He has already enslaved 4 veal men.
We met one of them in the redoubt. Was it your people who opened up and redecorated the place?
Oui, a very long time ago. It was where the white coats spawned the monsters from Okashnik's essence. His evil aura haunted it. So we tried to bless it, to sanctify it, to let the light and the air of the world into it. It was in vain. Once Okashnik was resurrected and he heard my prophecy, he dispatched his minions to lie in wait for you and the women.
How did he hear your prophecy?
I told Legrand, one of his minions. I had no choice.
It sounds to me like this is your fault.
How can I make you understand? This is all about preordainment, about fate, the road of destiny, about the powers of darkness swallowing the light of reason. When the rats appeared and the plague broke out, the swampies knew it was a sign of their master's imminent return. They could not release Okashnik himself because they could not touch his sepulcher. It was sealed by silver, by the cross of Saint Jean, but they knew vil men. Descendants of the white coats who created them would come here. History would repeat itself, and Okashnik would be tried by you again.
Then why didn't you stop the vil men from releasing him?
It was the will of the Loa!
Right.
He stood up so suddenly from the bench that the men with the rifles fumbled to bring them to bear. Kane ignored them.
Give us back our weapons and point us in the direction of the swampy settlement. We'll find our people and be on our way.
No.
No?
Grant pushed back from the table and assumed his full formidable height.
No. The time is not yet nigh. We strike at sunrise, at the first cockcrow, when his powers weaken.
What's this wee shit?
The Loa will be with us. He will incarnate in my body during the Humfo ritual. The Loa will mount me and ride me as his horse. During the ceremony, you will be purified.
Grant and Kane said nothing for a long tick of time, first glancing toward each other, then toward the bores of the rifle muzzles, staring at them like hollow eyes.
Why do I have the feeling that being purified won't be a simple matter of letting us take baths?
Your instincts serve you well, Monsieur Kane.
She went to the door and opened it. She struck the bell twice.
I call the Hunsi. Your purification begins.